want the Republicans to wake up is... What the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Free speech rights, academic rights in this country are under assault. And today we're going to meet one of the most recent victims. James Tracy was fired from a tenured position as a professor at a university in Florida because he ran a blog that challenged the official narrative of Sandy Hook, the Boston Marathon, and other stories that are often called conspiracy theories. As you're about to learn, James Tracy is no crackpot. He's a smart, well-informed individual who happens to ask a lot of questions. And I fully support his First Amendment rights and sharply criticize his termination from his university in Florida. The full conversation is straight ahead. It's made possible by people like you who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Jason Ferguson, Joey Perillo, and Wendy Gebauer. They're monthly subscribers. And let's mention Abby McMillan. She does four times more than she has to every month in support of my work, and I'm very grateful. If you've never heard your name mentioned here, why don't you become a subscriber? I'd be happy to give you credit as well. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click the menu button, then become a subscriber. The next page, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual subscription will earn you a bonus gift if you're inside the continental United States. You have a choice right now of choosing a copy of The Burn Pits by Joe Hickman, a powerful new book exposing wrongdoing in the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. Or on a lighter note, I've got copies of the Field Guide to the F-Word, and I'd be happy to send you one of those as my bonus gift for your new annual subscription at peterbcollins.com. Here in the United States, we're facing a crisis of free speech and academic freedom.
Your rights stop, or my rights crush you. If you want free speech, go to Russia.
That's a spoofy thing from Harry Shearer. Goes way back to 1990 when Bush 1 was in the White House. Today we're going to take on an issue of academic freedom, the firing of a tenured university professor for his off-site work on a blog and embracing or exploring controversial subjects and ideas. And I'm very concerned that if a tenured professor can lose his position because of a kind of hysteria created by a local newspaper and the failure of activists and people who support free speech and academic freedom to stand up and defend him, well, we're on a slippery slope. James F. Tracy joins me today. He was teaching at Florida Atlantic University until this past January when he was fired. We're going to go into detail about the reasons. He got his PhD at the University of Iowa. He is a communications professor. One of the courses he was teaching was about conspiracy theories. He also is active in the media himself. He runs the Memory Hole blog and also has an internet radio show. Professor Tracy, thanks for being with me today.
Well, thanks for having me on the program, Peter. Appreciate it.
I have covered your issues and your case intermittently over the last year or so based on coverage in the corporate mainstream media. And I'm really pleased to be able to get your story and your point of view directly from you without any filter or third-party distortion. Can we start with just a few basics? You were teaching at this university in Boca Raton since 2002. Give us a quick sketch. How big is Florida Atlantic University? How many students? How many faculty?
It's got about 800, 850 faculty, about 25,000 students total.
Mm-hmm.
There are six campuses, although Boca Raton, where I am and where I live, is the largest campus. The other campuses are more or less satellite
mm-hmm.
campuses. This is over three counties in southeast Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, I believe I've been here since 2002. It was my first gig out of graduate school at the University of Iowa, and it was a great place to come. I love living in Boca Raton. The culture of the campus and university itself is still largely a commuter school. A lot of working class students. We're very racially diverse, ethnically diverse, and many students are coming, it's their first generation at university. And so there's quite a variety of students in the classroom. I really do appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And from various socioeconomic backgrounds, and once again, ethnic and what have you.
And do I have it correctly that you were essentially the shop steward? You were a leader of the union that represents faculty members?
I was the head of the United Faculty of Florida, Florida Atlantic University chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Each state college and state university has a chapter of UFF. And so I was involved in that. I've been a member since I began at FAU.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the president for a couple of years, and we faced some real challenges then. At the time, the president of the university was Frank Brogan, who was previously the lieutenant governor under Jeb Bush here in Florida.
Mm.
And he and his administration attempted to fire a number of faculty, five faculty in the College of Engineering. And so it was a very tense time. Ultimately, the union prevailed, and we were able to resecure those faculty in their positions.
And were your union activities, in your opinion, a detriment to you as you faced your own personal disciplinary process that led to your firing?
Well, it was a number of years back. I don't believe that it ultimately did.
Mm-hmm.
I really can't delve into that a great deal, but this is something that was brought up in terms of the news coverage.
Mm-hmm.
They would mention that I was a former union official and things of the like, and so I think that observers are a bit mystified that I dropped the union-appointed attorney and retained a private one.
Mm.
That's something that I think it's kind of a mystery that's unresolved in the public eye.
Okay. And when were you granted tenure, and what specifically does tenure mean at Florida Atlantic University?
Well, it's a very good question. I was granted tenure in 2008, and overall, tenure essentially means that you have due process. There has to be cause in order to terminate you. Otherwise, you have a permanent position, and you can be assured of that unless there is some degree of, you know, gross misconduct or the equivalent. And my research, my teaching, my service were all above satisfactory or excellent from 2002 up until my last evaluation back in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that is required. Of course, if you are falling behind in terms of research, your teaching, the quality of the teaching is suffering, then they do put you on kind of a plan to get you back up to par. There was a controversial post-tenure review process that was proposed back in September of 2015. It's something that I wrote about on my blog and reported on. And there was a great deal of controversy that was generated because the administration wanted to implement this post-tenure review process that would have given administrators, in other words, deans of colleges and chairs, who are not in the bargaining unit of faculty, it would have given them a tremendous amount of authority and power to be able to terminate faculty. Mm-hmm. And faculty came together and said, this is something whereby tenure is effectively being eliminated here at FAU. So, you know, faculty sometimes is kind of like herding cats because we're all off. We're very independent. We're off doing our own research and so forth. And the faculty did come together in the fall and devised a policy whereby the faculty themselves would be more involved and their involvement would supersede that of the administration.
Mm-hmm. Now, we'll get into some of the details of the controversies that you covered in your blog. But fundamentally, did you maintain a firewall between your work at the university and your operation of the Memory Hole blog? And in particular, did you ever use university computers or facilities to manage, update, or in any way interact with your blog that could be seen as some sort of a conflict of interest or a misuse of the university's facilities?
Well, I had... when I began the blog in March of 2012, it was kind of on a lark. I wanted to examine issues and things that I had delved into to a certain degree in my work formally in the academy, but also look at current events. So that's something that that was the project the blog initially was. I began submitting things to alternative sites like Global Research, and they began picking them up, and it started to become quite a popular site throughout 2012. I always had a disclaimer on the blog and was careful about that. And the disclaimer initially gave my position, my title, and the fact that the remarks, the opinions on the blog do not represent the opinions of Florida Atlantic University or the state university system of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
The sticking point was in early 2013 when the blog did come to the university administration's attention due to this controversy concerning my analysis of the Sandy Hook massacre news coverage.
Mm-hmm.
They argued that the disclaimer was not salient enough. It wasn't on the front page. It was on the about page,
mm-hmm.
Which in fact is true, but I think this was a minor point. Ultimately, in that regard, I did fulfill all the requirements of separating my blog and my free speech and the personal blog and the material that was on it from my formal professional activities.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is that my friend Roger Schuler was an employee of the communications department at the University of Alabama. And privately, he operated a blog that investigated the way that former Governor Don Siegelman was railroaded into federal prison.
Oh.
And Roger is a talented journalist who did an excellent job of exposing the corruption around that case and other instances of corruption in the criminal justice system in Alabama. And he did sue over a wrongful termination, and the allegation was that he had used university time and equipment for his blog, and he proved that that was flatly untrue. And that's why I raised it in your case, because this is sometimes a way that an employer can infringe on the free speech rights without quite triggering a First Amendment case. Mm-hmm. Is any of that at play in your situation?
Yes, the Florida Atlantic University administration argued in their rationale for termination that I had not filled out and submitted outside activity or employment forms in a timely fashion. And this was something that they brought up in early 2013, in January of 2013, once again following the controversy concerning the Sandy Hook massacre coverage and my mm-hmm. remarks on that. At that time, I was advised by the union to not fill out the forms because the blog was personal and this was a free speech First Amendment issue. Mm. I, in turn, informed the administration of that I would not be filling out the forms, and they never brought it up again until November of 2015. So almost 3 years later, they brought it up, stating that you've got to fill these out, and you've got to do it within, 48 hours or else.
And they made that the nominal basis for your 10-year review and termination, not the actual expressions that you made. Is that right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, you bring up the matter of using university equipment, university property. And I had, I never used the computers at campus to update my blog or anything of the like. Following an agreement that we had reached in September of 2013 to settle a grievance that I had brought in early 2013 concerning a disciplinary letter that was put in my file because of they argued that the disclaimer on the blog was not sufficient. I mean, they were really grasping at straws. But anyway, mm-hmm. we settled that. And what I did do, I did have another project, which was essentially a podcast along the lines of what you do. Mm-hmm. And on a weekly basis, I would interview authors, professors, doctors, an interesting slew of people, and made a podcast. And I used the GarageBand software on campus. In order to produce those. So that was the use of university equipment. And in my view, this was something that really helped to make me a better scholar and journalist, talking to individuals like this, kind of having an excuse to be able to sort of ask them questions and become better informed. Now, this is something that is done on a regular basis, particularly among humanities scholars and social scientists in the academy, some of whom I know, some of whom are here at FAU. They might not be producing a podcast, but they are interviewing people in order to do their research and the like. So that was another thing that was cited, this use of university equipment and the fact that I did not file an outside activity or employment form for this activity. That's something else that most other faculty don't do either. In fact, mm-hmm. some of them have even informed me of that. And I was informed by my chairperson when I inquired about why they wanted for me to fill this out, why they wanted for faculty in general to acknowledge the outside activity policy. I was told that you only need to fill out the forms if you have outside employment or if you're doing something like consulting where mm-hmm. money is changing hands, because then, in fact, there could be a real conflict of interest between FAU, which is a state agency, and the entity that is employing you.
Dr. Tracy, you are someone who has become a scholar. You're a communications professor. You certainly are aware of the way media handles controversy in this country. And let me approach this in this way. I got to meet Bill Ayers a few years ago, and I asked him how weird and amusing and twisted it was to watch the way he was cartoonized, caricatured, in coverage by Fox News and other outlets. And so let me put a similar question to you. As you have seen your expressions, your commentary twisted, and you have been characterized as a wacky, crazy, dangerous professor, how does all that look to you when you're on the receiving end of this type of coverage and you flip on the TV and you say, wow, they're talking about me, and I don't even recognize that guy they're talking about.
Well, it's amazing the power that the media have, and I've been, I guess, a textbook case of this, my situation. It's what I study, how the media change and potentially transform public opinion. And I hear this from friends, from acquaintances, who remark that I don't recognize the person that they are presenting, you know, as being you. The attorneys that I've worked with over the past few months have they've said that they've commented to their acquaintances that, yeah, I'm representing James Tracy. You've heard about the professor at FAU, and their friends and acquaintances say, oh, that guy, he must be really weird. What's he like? Well, he's just an average guy. So the headlines and the sound bites, these are used in such a way in our society that to a large degree relies on them to be informed, and there's no way that they actually can be. But this, I think, is a larger kind of problem. People look at the news, they look at a news lead in an article, and they believe that they've been informed, and that, in fact, is not the case.
Well, and you've been the victim of sheer demagoguery, where, yeah, because what you are espousing, what you're expressing, is unpopular and conflicts with the established narrative of these kind of mega media and government events, that you're not just someone who has an unpopular opinion. You are dangerous, un-American, treasonous, other. And this is a really frightening development for me. Let me tell you that I share your concerns about the coverage of the Newtown events. I listened and watched the live coverage, and the narrative that developed was very much at odds. There are huge contradictions and conflicts. Similarly, with the Boston Marathon bombing, I've done a lot of coverage of that. And Russ Baker and the team at WhoWhatWhy.com are really the only national media outlet that approached that case with appropriate skepticism and demanded proof for the government's allegations, and also tried to explore the patsy nature of the Tsarnaev brothers' involvement, their uncle with the connections to Graham Fuller, the CIA guru. I mean, the way that the older brother was certainly on a watch list and had been the subject of communications between our government and Russian security. And so these cases raise a lot of questions. And we, those of us who challenge an official narrative, are routinely derided as crackpots, conspiracy theorists, nuts. And it works. This, yeah, whole effort to marginalize people who ask inconvenient questions is very effective.
Well, unfortunately, Who, What, Why, or Consortium News, or Peter B. Collins do great work, but they don't have a monopoly. They don't have a stranglehold on the media. You know, that's left to, unfortunately, the agenda-setting outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and Fox News. And they see the work that alternative journalists do as being a real threat. And that very label, conspiracy theorist, or, you know, wackadoodle, whatever, you know, the suggestion that you are irrational really does call your credibility into question in the public eye and the public mind because of the monopoly control, because the narrative and hence the reality is established by these major media. And once it's established and once it's set in people's minds, it's very difficult to displace, to dislodge, regardless of how many facts you have. We've seen this with the major political assassinations of the 1960s. We've seen this with the Oklahoma City bombing, with 9/11, the 7/7 London bombings, and more recently with these various mass shootings. What I've been careful to suggest on my blog that these are events that require interrogation. They require analysis, and I frequently will cite various facts and anomalies in the reportage. That's all I sought to do with the Boston bombing, with Sandy Hook, with San Bernardino, and yet simply by raising these questions, as you've done and as other alternative journalists have done, you risk being labeled a conspiracy theorist. I think that I was targeted especially because I had something that they could take away. They could try me in the court of public opinion and take away my livelihood, take away my profession, take away my reputation, which is what they have successfully done.
And you are probably quite familiar with this, but Lance DeHaven Smith from Florida State published the book Conspiracy Theory in America, and he publishes a copy of CIA Dispatch 1035-960, which was a reaction to the public's failure to accept the work of the Warren Commission. And they launched the whole meme of conspiracy theory as a negative term, as a denigrative descriptor, and it has held ever since. And let me ask you to comment on this, because I had a great conversation with Professor DeHaven Smith, but I had to beat him up on one issue, and that is his book about conspiracy theory in America doesn't include COINTELPRO, the FBI operation directed by J. Edgar Hoover that I helped uncover as a young journalist, a reporter back in the 1970s. And when I quizzed him on that, he said, yeah, it didn't pass peer review. So even when, you know, a well-intentioned individual like DeHaven Smith tries to expose the way conspiracy theory is used to dismiss things that have real merit, he wasn't even able to publish key elements of his thesis because the peer reviewers rejected it.
Yeah, and I think that that book itself is, to a large degree, beyond the pale in the academy. It's a meaningful argument. It has substance, and I think that it's very effective. In fact, I used it in my course on conspiracies, conspiracy theories, at FAU. I was eager to be able to incorporate it into the class. The fact that that book saw the light of day, I think, is an accomplishment. And it took the guidance of Mark Crispin Miller, who edited that series, who's a professor at NYU, who I think also looks at these various events with a great deal of skepticism. And, you know, he and DeHaven Smith and a handful of others, Peter Dale Scott, are among the few that are actually pushing the envelope. And even they have to be careful. And an example such as mine, where a tenured professor is fired, I'm sure gives those individuals great pause.
And since we've mentioned academia and some of your colleagues here, have they, in your opinion, been sufficiently supportive of your cause? And I'm not singling out Miller and DeHaven Smith, but just in general, have academics recognized that the threat to you is a threat to them?
No, I don't think so. Not to the extent that they actually could. Now, there are a number of professors that have come to my aid. We've established the James Tracy Legal Defense Fund. And we've been somewhat successful in generating revenue for my legal defense and representation in this case. But I'm afraid that a majority of colleagues, you know, have not seen this case as being something that is a threat to them. When I began my academic career back in graduate school and then going into FAU as a junior faculty member, I think my political views were somewhat different from what they are today. I was on the progressive left. I was a Marxist. And also, I used these perspectives in my work, you know, theories like commodification, which borrows from anthropology and the notion of fetishization, all these things, I think are still very useful in terms of looking at media and culture. Although over the past several years, my perspectives have taken a shift. I think I've become more quote-unquote libertarian. I look at capitalism as something that is undergirded by a central banking system, and that it's insufficient to look and critique solely capitalism without also looking at that broader financial structure, infrastructure, if you will. And in that regard, I think that I perhaps have become somewhat more radical, if radical means getting to the root cause of a problem and examining that root cause or those root causes. And now there's a lot of baggage with that. There's the argument that that some of my colleagues have actually stated to me face to face, have you become right wing? I've questioned things such as what passes for climate science that's accepted by the Obama administration, and so that makes me a climate denier. I've questioned the overall integrity of the LGBT movement that is heavily foundation funded and is not organic. We're not talking about Stonewall here. We're talking about millions of dollars that creates really in many ways a grassroots movement. I guess that makes me, anti-gay. I have questioned things such as Sandy Hook and argued that it may, in fact, have to do with gun control. So that makes me a right-wing gun nut. So all of these things have, I think, they have separated me, isolated me to a certain degree from dozens of people that I have formerly counted as colleagues in the past. And I don't regret that, really. I think that I've evolved intellectually. I think that I'm asking questions that I want to be able to entertain and to examine before I go into old age or before I, mm-hmm. I pass along. And I'm just looking at those things in a different way. But I'm disappointed that there aren't more colleagues who have not understood this. As one example, interestingly, from my previous years, sort of, I guess, on the other side of the aisle, that's at least how some others perceive it as being, one colleague donated some money to my defense fund, and at the same time, he emailed me and said, I'm sorry, I have to do this anonymously because I don't have tenure at present. Mm-hmm. So that gives you an idea of the kind of the chilling effect.
Professor, yeah. Let me just interject here that you gave us a litany of your views, and I don't really feel compelled to go through them point by point and say, oh, I agree with this, I don't agree with that. What I agree with is your right to think independently and to express any goddamn thing you want to say. And I think that it's important for you to challenge, for example, my acceptance of climate science. And I'm not offended that you would expose that LGBT organizations get massive funding from foundations and individuals that make them a part of the establishment in this current spurious debate. The fundamental point here that I, will yield to no one on is your First Amendment rights. They're not optional. They're not situational. They're not based on whether there's a terrorist threat or you hurt somebody's feelings in Newtown, Connecticut. And this, to me, is just a bedrock of the American system. And if we, give ground on that from any direction, we all lose.
I agree entirely. I think that if we don't have a marketplace of ideas that is vibrant, it's something that we unfortunately don't have today. I think that the internet provides prospects for that, but on the whole, the major corporate media still have a tremendous amount of power. as is suggested in my situation.
Mm-hmm. And did you take any interest in the case of Stephen Salida at the University of Illinois? He, of course, put out some tweets that were considered intemperate that showed that he supports the Palestinians, and this became a real conflict at the University of Illinois. And a member of the Kennedy family who runs the place got him fired. And then Salida did successfully win a lawsuit and a cash settlement from the university. But he didn't get his job back, did he?
No, he didn't. That's tremendously unfortunate. I believe my understanding is that he was brought on a tenure track position, and they refused to actually honor that. He did not have tenure at the time that he was that his employment was terminated, or he was not allowed to go there and occupy that position.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's a pervasive and really troubling pattern. The Center for Constitutional Rights published a report in January that showed that at more than 60 university campuses in the last 2 years, there have been events where those who were critical of the state of Israel were silenced in some form or another, or events were canceled or moved, or the organizations that wanted to sponsor them lost their sanction. So we also see this effort to suppress on campuses support for the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanction from Israel. And I consider that just to be a fundamental First Amendment issue. I have a right to determine how I spend my dollars, what companies I invest in if I own shares, and that I can direct that based on my political views. And yet there is this remarkable effort to impose an exceptional standard for the state of Israel.
Yeah, there is a dimension of that in my termination as well. People have emailed me and suggested that the Jewish community in South Florida, which is very powerful, and there are a good many donors in that community to Florida Atlantic, that they were instrumental in my termination. I have no way of proving that. I have no way of knowing if that in fact is the case. But they are tremendously influential here at FAU and the state of Florida. There are individuals on the board of trustees who I was also told were petitioning for my termination since 2013, and they are Republican Party operatives, very close with the state of Israel. There is a Florida Israel Institute that is housed in part at Florida Atlantic University and also at Broward Community College, or Broward State College now, I believe it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are clear ties, and that's an underlying element of this. The letter that was, or the opinion piece that was published by the South Florida Sun Sentinel on December 10th, which I believe prompted my termination, apparently written by a couple of parents of a child who allegedly died at the Sandy Hook massacre, pushed a number of buttons in terms of mentioning a colleague of mine, Jim Fetzer. He's included a number of my essays in his recent books on Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing. I've appeared on his podcast. He's appeared on mine.
Sure, I know Jim, going back to the 9/11 investigations. Jim has been very outspoken on all of these issues.
Very insightful, very well-intentioned and intelligent person. Well, he was referred to in this opinion piece written by the Posners as a Holocaust denier. And so when you begin to go into that territory and make remarks like that, this is very damaging given the community and the climate that FAU is in.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit first about the Posners and then about the newspaper. I was just about to get to them, so I'm glad you brought them up. The way the media has generally played this is that you attacked the Posners and that you offended them by sending a certified letter demanding that they prove that their child had existed. But that really is the second half of the story, as I understand it. And the versions that I've seen typically don't include how this originated. So would you please give the backstory to your contacts with the Posners and why this is served up in this very selective manner to make you look like a really insensitive asshole?
Well, Lenny Posner sent a, he filed a Digital Millennium Copyright Act infringement claim on my blog for using an image of Noah Posner, his son, who died in the Sandy Hook massacre. That's the official narrative, of course, using this on my blog. And he had filed a number of infringement, copyright infringement claims against other alternative media outlets, YouTube channels and blogs, and was successfully in shutting down a number of YouTube channels. You know, no judge, no jury, no anything. And so I thought I would take him to task and send a letter to him requesting forensic evidence and formal official verification that he in fact owned this image that he claimed under penalty of perjury that he had a right to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the essence of my letter to him back in March of 2015.
Mm-hmm. But just to be very clear here, Professor, you didn't intentionally try to engage him. He started this with the spurious copyright claim. Yet I'm looking at a headline here from the Daily Beast in just this past December. This professor trolled Sandy Hook parents.
See, now, that's a distortion, of course, of what actually took place. And in fact, I did not address this to Veronique Posner. It was addressed to the Honor Network, H-O-N-R Network, which is the mm-hmm. nonprofit organization that Lenny Posner has established to harass and stalk researchers of the Sandy Hook event.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what it's involved in doing.
And Professor, I just want to acknowledge that this is part of a larger effort. The state of Connecticut passed some bizarre laws to limit investigations, to sharply curtail access to public records. They, of course, destroyed the school and built a new one there. There are many curious moves that were taken to suppress investigations and to try to cement the official narrative in place. And so this action by the Posners, I see as kind of an extension of that.
Yes, I would agree. And it's something that whereby they are able to reinforce the narrative that is already set down in many people's minds. Not everyone. I think there are skeptical individuals out there, but majority of people, or perhaps the vocal majority, or what is perceived anyway as being the public opinion of the country, because the this goes back to my initial premise back in early 2013 that journalists and news organizations never did their job. Maybe that was never their intent, but as far as actually asking the questions that needed to be asked and delving into the nooks and crannies of this particular story, that was never done.
Well, and let me underscore that, Professor, because that's my orientation as well. I'm a media, a creature of the media, and when I see my colleagues go soft, fail to ask the obvious questions, fail to pursue the threads that are dangling right before them. People who won't even, you know, look at Senator Bob Graham's critique of the 28 missing pages that he says would show that the Saudis financed 9/11. People put on their blinders and then point at us and claim that we're wearing tinfoil hats. I mean, those imageries never worked for me. But people are proud to be ignorant and to maintain their ignorance. They do not want to be bothered with contradictions and the obvious questions that confront what are unfortunately obvious lies.
Well, this is something that I think is a overarching notion that much of the public still has, and that is that we live in an open democratic society where our institutions still actually function as they were intended. Our political institutions, legislative, judiciary, law enforcement, all of these things work, as well as the media. It has its problems, but for the most part, it works. And if there was any real conspiracy, we'd be told about it. We'd be informed. This is the basic argument of Noam Chomsky in the wake of 9/11, right? No conspiracy like that could ever sustain itself for very long. And I think that is overall incorrect. And, a lot of these particular events bear that out. But in addition, I think people find it too disturbing actually to go there. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great deal of cognitive dissonance. Well, because if they acknowledge something like as journalists, as scholars in particular, it's very damaging. It's damaging to their professional reputation, being called or, tainted as a conspiracy theorist or someone who's interested in those sorts of things. So, that's something that jeopardizes your cultural capital and everything too. So it's... people ultimately, once they acknowledge that there are real problems, such as the particular thing that you brought up with regard to Senator Graham and 9/11, those types of things, well, then you have to actually do something about it if you want to be honest with yourself. And I think that many people just find that too inconvenient, or they're in their defense, they're too busy. With today's economy, they might be working two or three part-time jobs. So that's part of it, too.
Well, imagining that there is some, murky department that generates the scripts for these official narratives. Number one, they don't do a very good job on continuity, and San Bernardino is a glaring example of that. But the thing that they build in, and forgive my language, and this is not quite an academic term, but they build in what I call a mind fuck, where you are confronted with two types of darkness, and you have to decide if you are going to turn away from the darkness that leads to our own government leaders, our own corporate leaders, and complicity or direction in events that left, innocent civilians dead. And for most people, the processor shuts down in the face of this, mind fuck, and you go in the other direction. You fall in line and accept a consensus position, even as you observe that the story doesn't hold up to careful scrutiny.
And the journalistic institutions, the establishment journalistic outlets, go along with that. And that is what ultimately comprises our history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now let's turn to the South Florida Sun Sentinel. This is owned by the Tribune Company out of Chicago. Is that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they basically just decided that you were a rich target and they were going to get you. I've seen, excerpts from their coverage, and it's stunning to see how loaded and these are in the news columns, not editorials, how loaded the coverage was. You have attempted to correct the record, and they basically pat you on the head, say, nice try, never mind.
Yes, I wrote an open letter to the South Florida Sun Sentinel back in May of 2015, and specifically to Howard Saltz, who is the editor-in-chief there, actually linking to, providing URLs to all of the opinion pieces and the news coverage concerning my blog, my personal blog, and my remarks on Sandy Hook and the Boston Marathon bombing, my analysis of the press coverage of both of those events. And I said that this is arguably defamatory. This is arguably libelous. And Saltz personally responded, I'm sure this was likely a statement that was written by their attorney, mm-hmm. but stating essentially that we don't consider this to be libelous, that we have, you know, our opinion writers and reporters, they're looking for good stories. You're a public figure. You're a figure with considerable influence, being a university professor. And you should expect that type of scrutiny given your views, your perspectives. But the Sun Sentinel was the paper that did the initial story on me back on January 8th of 2013, focusing on my remarks on Sandy Hook. And that became, you know, an international story, the story of the conspiracy or conspiracy theory professor. But it's interesting, the reporter himself, Mike Clary, the way that he got his foot in the door was to contact me at my residence, and they had my numbers. They know who I am because I was previously the union president, mm-hmm. And state to me that I was in a row with the administration concerning my blog and that the administration was going to discipline me because of my blog. Well, perhaps that was a self-fulfilling prophecy because I was ultimately terminated, but, the university didn't know anything about my blog until the Sun Sentinel wrote the story, and until it took off, you know, and became a major story throughout the land. So again, something of a self-fulfilling prophecy on their part. I think quite unethical. Ultimately, what this reporter wanted to get me to do was to go on the record stating that there were crisis actors at Sandy Hook. And I never said that. I said that the Department of Homeland Security contracts with such acting troops, and perhaps that was a factor there. Perhaps that explains some of the anomalies in the coverage and the reportage. But I never said, I would never admit to that to him. But he was very adamant about getting me on the record stating that that I did state that, and I never did. But that was one of many of the distortions that they overall accomplished in the public mind.
This is a common tactic in discrediting so-called truthers, and that is those of us who have honest and well-thought-out skepticism about an official narrative are challenged with a claim that comes from a fringe group or a fringe thinker. And yeah. If I say I don't believe the official narrative about 9/11, they say, well, you tell me the planes didn't fly into buildings? And it's like, well, no, I didn't say that.
Yeah.
No plane flew into Building 7, and it came down in 11 seconds, but you didn't ask me that. So, you know, this is a real effort to distort and avoid arriving at any honest, fact-based assessment. And as we wrap up here, Professor, tell my listeners what you've learned from this and what we need to learn from it.
Well, overall, that there are definitely, you know, certain parameters to speech, to discourse in the United States, particularly with journalists and scholars. And there are certain terrain that we cannot, or avenues we cannot go down. And that's unfortunate in a society that purports to be free, you know, whereby there's this notion that we have a free press. There's this idea that that we can actually pursue any form of knowledge and fact-finding and come to our own conclusions and form our own opinion, this notion of self-autonomy. of intellectual autonomy is very powerful in America specifically. And so there are definitely compromises there. That's actually not the case. And I think that unfortunately, my case speaks to that perhaps more loudly than any other. There are other academics as well, though, today who their jobs, their tenure is being threatened along similar lines, saying the wrong thing, being perceived as politically incorrect or racist. Both college administrators and professors have been threatened. By their students, by their trustees, or what have you, their donors, and so it's something that is tremendously concerning, and it's something that requires, I think, greater discussion and greater debate. My case, as well as these others.
Professor James Tracy has set up a legal defense fund. I'm going to list the mailing address in the show file for this podcast, and if you're able and so inclined, I encourage you to support him. James Tracy, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me on, Peter. Very much appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this important conversation with embattled Professor James Tracy. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to until we meet again, happy trails.